You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Ricky Ducournay, whose new novel, Phosphor in Dreamland, has just been published by the Dalkey Archive Press. She is a novelist. She has published The Stain, Entering Fire, The Fountains of Neptune, and The Jade Cabinet. Those are a tetralogy. She is a short story writer, the author of The Complete Butcher's Tales. She is a poet, a writer of children's books, a potter, and an illustrator. This image of the writer seems very much to me to come from an idea of writing as a combination of art and magic. And I wonder where your idea of what a writer is comes from.
Well, I love the idea of art and magic because, indeed, it is a magical exercise. You know, you take the raw stuff of daily life and all these transformations take place, a lot of them deep in the body of the subconscious somewhere. It's sort of magical and alchemical simultaneously. Well, things simmer and cook for a while, and then at some point they surface and astonish you, even though you're the writer of them. You wonder where this is all coming from. So it does seem like rabbits out of a hat or something. But suddenly there are these voices and architectures and landscapes and gardens and strange ideas, and there they are. I don't have anything to do with them.
But, for instance, I suspect that you, me too, began fairly early on with a fixation and fascination with Lewis Carroll that made you have to read not just the Alice books, but Sylvian Bruno as well. Not just Sylvian Bruno, but his logic puzzles and his Mathematica Fantastica. That somehow or other, the artist, rector, logician, the multiple figure of the artist seems very much looming behind these books.
Well, I think that's so. Perhaps, too, I mean, yes, Lewis Carroll, my chosen great-grandfather, you know, tremendously important to me. But I started off not as a writer, as you know, I think. I started off as an artist, as a painter and illustrator, graphic artist, printmaker, and really was seized by the scruff of the neck by my first book. It took me by surprise. Suddenly there was a book, something, I had read something which utterly enraged and dismayed me, and the only way of dealing with it really was to write a book, or so it seemed.
What was it that you'd read?
I'd read an account by, this was, I believe it was 1970, there'd been a coup d'etat in Greece, and a woman had survived torture. She'd been raped with a broomstick and had aborted her fetus and survived somehow to tell what had happened to her. And reading that was so profoundly distressing. I found myself writing a series of very dark little poems and very brief fictions about torture and about totalitarian states. And they were like fairy tales from hell. But that experience led to another book and then another book. And then I found that that's what was taking up almost all my time. And art became, in a way, secondary. I mean, I've never stopped, but the most of my time is spent with words these days.
That's what's so interesting to me. You bring me to a second thought. I know I've seen your illustrations for a Robert Coover story, mm-hmm. and you illustrated as well Borges's very great encyclopedic fiction, Tlan Ukbar Orbis Tertius, a world full of imaginary and philosophical essential presences. Into those worlds of the impossible, which might be the world of contemporary fiction, or at least the contemporary fiction of Coover, Borges, et al., this more political, more violent more contemporary world has been thrust, and it's what makes the book so interesting to me, that they are not simply architectures of fairyland. And I think that fantasy seems to require revolution. I remember that in The Land of Oz is a feminist revolution going on, and there's a revolution as well in Sylvie and Bruno. I think the people are calling for less bread, more taxes in that particular case. But is there a desire to wed the imagination with the terrors of the present?
Perhaps not so much a desire as a species of necessity that I find. I'm compelled to write in that way, that politics seems to inform everything. I think I may have mentioned to you in a previous conversation how much I love Italo Calvino as well, and he says somewhere that the work is always informed by who we are. And I think that is so, especially writing from what I call the center as I do. So it's not a didactic exercise. I don't set about with the idea that I will write specifically about something which has enraged me or concerned me, but that concern or that anger is always there, as well as, of course, great delight in the world. But it certainly does inform what I do. And I cannot forget that woman's story that I mentioned. There's so many stories I cannot forget. You know, you mentioned Oz, and I just read recently that, to my tremendous dismay, that Frank Baum was one of the people who called for the genocide of the Indians. Did you know that? I didn't
know
that.
No idea.
He was a journalist.
A newspaper editor?
Yes.
Yeah.
And his argument was, well, this is a race that is now nothing but thieves and wastrels. I mean, it's a destroyed race, and I think it was intolerable for him, apparently, to... Perhaps it was guilt. Who knows? Who knows what compels such behavior? But he said, it's too late for them. We must finish with it once and for all. This is a man who wrote such delightful books for children. Is that visible anywhere, do you think? Do you see that attitude?
I'm another admirer. I guess listeners to Bookworm can't help but know by now that the fondest place in my heart is for certain kinds of fantastic literature. And I sometimes think, you know, so much of what Baum wrote is bad. I mean, Dot and Tot and Maryland and mm-hmm. things of this sort, and even Queen Zixi of Ix. I guess this is a hugely idealistic statement on my part, but I tend to think that it would be impossible to be a good artist, a truly mm-hmm. good artist, and maintain feelings of this sort. Now, I know everyone will call in and tell me things about D'Annunzio and all sorts of horrible things about artists, and yet I think that, especially in fantasy, the impurity of your vision will mar your art, and I think that must be the case with Frank Baum.
Oh, that's interesting. I felt that way about Celine, that Celine reveals himself over time to being the sort of desperate maniac that he is. I mean, this obsession with the other as a danger mars the work, so that his early work is interesting and maybe in some odd way informed by this, which his own rage, his own anti-Semitism and his own terrors and so on. It's not clear at the beginning, but it becomes clearer and clearer with the passage of time, and it does interfere with the work because it becomes cranky and obsessive and uptight in the most literal way. I mean, it becomes sort of caged in its own despair and anger.
I've recently read a quote that says that style is the fingerprint of who you are on what you do. And I think perhaps that to some extent, your own work, you are like a funnel, and the world enters in its horror, but your style, your fingerprint, is the strain of the fantastic, that all of this will be filtered by your style, which comes very much from myth and fairy tale, legend, allegory, satire, but the forms that involve the phantasmatic.
That's such an interesting idea. You know, while you were just speaking, I was thinking of my love for the vanitas, you know, those Renaissance paintings in which you see beautifully painted, I mean, these things are always technically absolutely perfect, a wonderful transparent glass of ruby red wine and perhaps an opened oyster and a peeled orange. I mean, a collection of objects that speak to the beauties of the world. Usually there's a lute as well or a piece of precious material or whatever. But then in a corner, there's a fly or there's a skull. And so these things always are about vanitas, about the passing of time, that nothing lasts. But you're attracted to them because of the fact that they are technically so perfect and engaging, and the still lives are always so appealing. And that's what brings you there. And then you discover that, yes, indeed, there's something else going on. It's not all delight.
It seems to lead us directly to the subject of phosphor in dreamland, as a matter of fact, a book in which a woman who is now the naturalist on an extraordinary island, what is the island's name?
Birdland.
is writing to her mentor. She is working in the Natural History Museum, and her work seems to involve a possible heresy. That is to say, is it right to capture the transience of nature and time on a botanical slide? Should one embalm and preserve history? And in this, her concern mirrors the concern of the hero, Phosphor, who has invented an early version of a camera, and then a camera obscura, and then a sort of laser that allows for three-dimensional images to occur. And the question is this a usurpation of the natural and spiritual world? Are you afraid of that, or is that a merely literary concern?
No, what I think I'm investigating there, and it seems to be something that I've investigated before, actually, is this problem of terror and our species' attempt to contain a sprawling world. And so what happens in this book is Phosphor is the inventor, which could have been possible. I mean, he is one of the many inventors of the camera obscura. Once the camera obscura was invented, the camera could have been invented very quickly after. So the idea of the book is that this happens impossibly early, but in fact possibly early on this isolated island. It happens about very early 17th century that somebody has invented a camera, and then he's invented a stereoscopic camera, in fact, so there aren't even any lasers involved. So he is an artist and an inventor, and his own desire really is, I think, one that is a liberating desire, the desire of the artist to somehow explore the world in this way. So not so much contain, but capture something long enough perhaps to look it over. But he immediately is taken under the wing of Fango the Phantasma, who is one of the villains of the book, who is desperate to contain, and he sees this process, the photographic process, as a magical process. He doesn't realize that it's a scientific process at all. He believes that Phosphor is a necromancer of some kind. And so he wants this process for himself. He feels that if he can have photographs enough, he can own the island. And that's an old concern as well, that the idea that you fix something, somehow you own it. When you think of Native Americans refusing to be photographed, with this terror that they would somehow be seized and owned and lose their liberty. Perhaps they were right. So that's the, I think, the center of that concern. But then the other thing that happens is the fact that we have these artifacts, so that, in fact, the narrator is not the woman who works in the museum, but the man who will become her lover. That means that the narrator has all this information, and I, as are you, I'm delighted with artifacts of all kinds, and I haunt museums and libraries. And I'm always delighted when I come upon vestiges of the past that I can read in some way. So that is what he is doing. He has found these wonderful old photographs and stereoscopic slides and bones and bits of feather coats, and is putting a story together.
I'm speaking to Ricky Ducournay upon the publication of her most recent novel, Phosphor in Dreamland, from the Dalkey Archive Press. In a sense, the argument here is very close to that of Susan Sontag in her book on photography, that the world imprisoned on a photograph is a world being imperialized. In the case of your novel, most of these artifacts are the artifacts of a destroyed Aboriginal race. And so there's the double sense that on the one hand, these are a record of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, they are the only records of the presence of a civilization that's been very beautiful. So the novel, as usual, is morally
That's
fragile.
Right. And they're also subversive artifacts. And so what happens at the end is that these artifacts from a people who have been destroyed keep resurging, and they're often erotic artifacts. So they also inspire the speaker of the tale, who will finally be able to fall in love, just as Phosphor by the end of the tale can fall in love. So it is about the resurgent capacities of the imagination and of the erotic imagination, and the fact that that things really cannot be kept down. You know, that you may think that you have destroyed a group, but something will remain. And so in a way, it's a very optimistic book, too, because by the end of the book, the Aboriginal culture is returning somehow in the form of wonderful meals and in the form of music, old stories, and then these very sexual artifacts.
I thought I'd ask you to read a section from one of the last chapters in Phosphor in Dreamland, which strikes me as addressing many of these issues, both the imprisoning aspects of photography and the erotic aspects of living culture. Ricky Ducournay reading from Phosphor in Dreamland.
Okay, let's see. This section, the central character is the Inquisitor, Ray Secundo, who is looking at some of these artifacts himself. I mean, he sees these slides. He sees them as an heretical exercise. He also sees them as necromantic. Okay. And it seemed to them that here, indeed, the world had been seized as within the fist of God and shrunk. And yet, these frozen instants, these particles of the real, evoked such powerful emotions that everyone who saw them knew they were magical. When one had seen the backside of one's wife as she bent over a bushel of guavas, that backside appeared in reality to have diminished drastically, as if the image captured on glass had more weight than the original, which in point of fact it had. For long after a wife had moldered and atomized under the ground, her image, kept safely in a mahogany box along with so many other images of a lost world, would survive, so that the ocular scope had this nefarious effect upon all the citizens of Birdland who turned its brass knob. From the time they had looked at their island and its population reduced to chemical powders and glass, the real seemed less real and thus less precious. Also speaking about television, obviously. Until then, transience was cherished for giving life its poignancy and meaning. Now that it could be kept filed away and retrieved at any moment, the real world seemed not only less real, but also less desirable. For a few pennies, one might gaze upon a naked beauty in her bath, and thereafter desire that fictive being more than any real woman of flesh. The inquisitorial office was informed of the heresy. Phantasma was arrested for promulgating necromancy, as was Nuno Alpha y Omega, and the box was confiscated. Ray Secundo examined the slides with a growing excitement. The images were profoundly seductive. For days altogether he gazed in terror and famishment at the vanished Cosima, with whom he was already intimate, and who was now the talk of the town. And if he had previously been captivated by her in two dimensions, the ocular scope provided him with three. Thus was his pleasure and his pain expanded. Secundo justified his fascination by choosing to consider his emissions as a purge, a temporary forfeiture of grace that caused him to dream constantly of hell. These dreams were a species of expiation. They provided him with a raw matter of prayers such as he had never before uttered, an inspiration and a fire he had never before known. He looked upon his own intense excitement as a proof of sortilege. The more he gave into it, the greater was the evidence of glamour. If the creature in the box was an illusion created by a puissant sorcerer, and his traffic with her not corporeal but virtual, the Inquisitor's own powers now tested were greater. His member did not dissolve, as was customary in such cases. When forgotten by all but for God, he in his tower admired its moonlit substantiality and compared it to the bell tower of a great cathedral. He recalled with a shudder the church's unbounded influence over the transient world, and he recalled the poet's interest in the forbidden Eastern obscenities. After a brief investigation, he learned that Phosphor had accompanied the heretic Faginius and the madman Phantasma on a pilgrimage to the pagan sites in the aboriginal forest. Tardanza's house was searched, his dream materials were taken, as well as Phosphor's manuscript, which was delivered to the Inquisitor, who sat upon a pewter chaise percée in a spare room with an impeccably mopped and polished floor. The box, this is referring to the oculoscopic box of photographs, and the poem, Segundo wrote in his report to the Spanish authorities, doth procure illusory glamours and cause combustion of the internal organs and unclean dreams. Both are the devil's own repositories of seductions, powerful enough to seduce entire populations.
Ricky Ducournay, reading from her most recent novel, Phosphor in Dreamland, published by Dalkey Archive Press. Now, I want to describe or find where this prose comes from. There are bits and pieces of Blake, it seems to me, in the vision of the body. It seems very, there's an element that always seems to me sort of Aubrey Beardsley-esque, you know. But can you, how do you describe your prose, or do you ever?
I don't, if I can get away with it. I don't know, that's interesting, you know. I loved Blake as an adolescent, and that's very possible. That's an influence that never occurred to me, and Beardsley, too, around the same period. Long time ago, but Isaac Dinesen, I feel very close, or felt very close to Isaac Dinesen. Maybe there's a connection there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it seems, you know, most writing now in this fantastic vein seems to be very bleak and dystopian. But the mere beauty of your language makes this prose kind of transcendent and light and kind of lovely, you know. It has an opium effect.
Well, maybe this has to do with having come to it as a poet first and also as a painter. I mean, I do have Bosch in mind often when I'm writing, or Vermeer, or those Vanitas I told you about. I mean, I really I want a prose that is very, very, in a way, very rigorous and very rich simultaneously. So, in fact, it's very cut down. It's very clean. I mean, I feel hopefully the bones are good and there's no extraneous matter. But at the same time, the language is rich. And I love language. And it seems that words engender words in, again, very mysterious ways. So that I found a species of wind begins to blow and I'm swept along with just the sounds of words often, though they're always, I feel, always at the service of the story or always at the service of character. They should never clutter or get in the way. You know, I don't want to become weighty or purple prosy, but I do love language, and as I love those rich paintings of Vermeer or Latour, and I like to work with light and dark as well, and I'm aware of that in a painterly fashion. I think when I'm writing, technically, light and darkness, or the idea of weather passing, clouds passing in front of a window, I mean, that kind of constant change, the mutable world. I'd like to get that across in the language too, that there are constant mood changes throughout the text as well.
I'd forgotten Spencer. I should have known. All of those enchantresses and turns of morality. and politics as well. I wanted to ask a final question. At the bottom of the pages of this book is the running commentary of, I assume, a fictitious critic, female, of the work of Jonathan Swift.
Yes.
I wondered. Tell me about her.
This is Alicia Ombos, who has written a book about Jonathan Swift and my character, Phosphor, who is also a great poet. And very much like Swift, also at the beginning of the book, absolutely terrified of the feminine. And, you know, Swift was terrified of the feminine. That's well known. And I think he saw the feminine as a kind of a hoax. I mean, as a species of vanitas, that, you know, you see the beautiful. You see someone who is beautiful, and yet she's really just a cesspool after all. And of course, Swift was writing at a time when women walked around with great masks of lead paint on their face, and they were indeed walking cesspool. I mean, their skin was rotting beneath that mask, their teeth falling out, their hair falling out. So that Swift's poem, for example, on beauty, where he describes a beauty coming home and removing her eyes and her teeth and her wig and the whatever her bodice has been made of, I mean, sort of upholstery, really is it's all about sex and death, and it's all about his own terror of the diminishing transient body. So it's, in a way, I feel Swift sort of blames women for what he blames himself for, that is, being mortal. And at the beginning of the book, Phosphor, my character too, is really terrified of death, abysses, secret hidden places, coffins, and he sees women in that category. And it's not until he goes on this pilgrimage, begins to really think about and engage in the world and ultimately engage in the corporal world, that he can become a lover and become a transient, or rather not a transient being, but both a transient and a transcendent being. So the book is also very tantric, I think, in that respect. It has a sort of tantric high at the end of it.
I've been speaking to Ricky Ducournay upon the publication of her new novel, Phosphor in Dreamland, published by Dalkey Archive Press. It's a pleasure to see you again, Ricky.
Pleasure to see you again. Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse, wow.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.